I'm just going to introduce now Stacey. I'm going to read their bio, and then they're going to come and share something with us, which is great. So Stacey Boucher is a curator, writer, caregiver, and death companion based in Utrecht. And broadly, Stacey focuses on aesthetic and poetic practices of social reproduction and care work, as well as its manifestations in interpersonal relationships and daily life, community organizing, and institutional practice. Their long-term transdisciplinary project, Dying Lovingly, looks at the architecture and communal life of hospice and highlights emergent cultures of end-of-life care. In the Netherlands, Stacey has taught at the Sandberg Institute, the Dutch Art Institute, and the Master of Fine Arts at HKU. And they're going to teach a course at the KBK in 2023. From 2017 to 2022, they were a curator at Casco Art Institute, working for the Commons. And they oversaw its exhibition program, its archive, and did a lot of work around accessibility, which I think they'll tell you something about today.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you. Oh, Akash, hey. It's really nice to be with all of you. I'm going to try something a little different. Usually I prepare a presentation where I write the whole thing and then I read it like this. And I thought that actually maybe today, oh, hey, it's so nice to see all of you here. So I thought today I could just speak a little bit more about myself personally. It seems like an appropriate time because I'm in this transition period of having just left Casco. I mean, I haven't completely left Casco in many ways. It's still near and dear to my heart. But now that I am on to different types of work, I thought that it could be nice to share a little bit of maybe how I got to this point, and especially including my accessibility organizing. At the end, I want to point you to two resources that was a lot of labor into putting them together, like a... Is that a signal or something? But at the end, I would like to share these two resources, which are really practical and concrete. But also, before I forget, my name is Stacey Boucher. For those tuning in on the live stream too, hello. I have short brown hair. I am white with a bit of a sunburn going on. I have a little bit of freckles. I'm wearing a white button-down shirt and also some blue trousers and gray Reebok sneakers. It's really nice. The group also nicely spaced, you know, in front of us here, and it's nice to also be in Framer Frame. So thank you for hosting, and also thanks to Hackers and Designers. I'll start a little bit at the beginning, like really the beginning. I look down at my phone occasionally because I have some notes here, but I first wanted to explain a little bit about when I was little, because I think that this helps to form my disposition of how I am here. I've always found myself to be a really sensitive person. I have kind of a soft demeanor, so maybe that means certain people might listen to me. I might be kind of annoying to other people. But I've always been really sensitive, and even so much that when I was little, and especially around when anyone would make fun of my grandma, my brothers, like just little innocent jokes, things like that, I would always get so upset, especially like making fun of her age or her abilities. I would get so upset that I would just start crying. It was I mean, at the time, it's just, I mean, when I think back on it, it's a little comical. And my mom's like, oh, it's okay, Stacy, it's okay, it's just a joke. And I think I'm still kind of the same way. I don't take jokes very well, especially when they're at someone else's expense. The other thing is that growing up, my mom always worked with people with disabilities, complex PTSD and trauma, and she would work with them through therapeutic riding, so horseback riding. And I always found it really amazing. It was also like really normal. It wasn't a sort of paternalistic kind of thing. It was just like, that's just what you do, you know, like we're all helping each other. So I think that these two things are a little bit of kind of, yeah, what kind of brought me to some of the places that I'm at now, or how I'm thinking. At the same time, it's not just that. It's not just my nature-nurture situation. Once I went into graduate school to much more like focus on my curatorial practice, that's when I started getting into accessibility work. And at the time, it was just, just crash course, not really knowing so much, but knowing that I wanted to do it. I was really influenced by a particular cohort of artists around the New York City area, which some of you may know, but Park MacArthur, Tina Zavatsanos, Carolyn Lazard, Taranay Fazeli, and more. But these in particular were really kind of changing. They were really, of course, being a part of the legacy of disability justice and activism, but they brought it into contemporary art in a way that was really palpable and legible to me. So then I was like, oh, okay. I started to learn so much more about actually access as something that's not just about logistics and practical things, but it's also about like a culture and a way of being, and also many, many more things. But just to make sure I don't totally go off track. But so while at CCS Bard in 2016 for the graduating thesis, I was really working hard to get an access note on the flyer, on the invitation to our graduate thesis shows. And it was so hard. It was like I had to go through all this administration. I drafted an access note. I did a lot of work around figuring it out, and then it went through many different people just to come back out the other end saying something like, the building is FDA approved. I mean, so it's like basic. It just had a very simple line about something. It just it was really underwhelming. And I also didn't feel like I had a lot of support. And so a bit of an isolating experience. And I thought, okay, you keep going. So I think that's why I wanted to talk a little bit more about like just doing this work for the long haul. No matter where we're all at in our perspectives on accessibility or just like what we're dealing with in our changing bodies and how we're learning. You know, we're all kind of working on this and waiting for each other to arrive. And I find that it's important to see ourselves in this sort of slow, long-term engagement of doing this. Then, kind of fast forward, 2019, December 31st, 2019, so 3 months before the pandemic, began, and also so much has changed since then, but I fainted after using the sauna, and it has led me on this incredibly painful journey. I fainted, I landed on my head, and I had a really bad concussion for about 6 months, and so in many ways, once everything closed down, I was like, and it was such a reprieve. But so I had to get some work done on my teeth and just heal. There was a lot of healing. And then almost a year later, I realized actually all these other issues I was having that happened actually in the same fall. So now I live with something called thoracic outlet syndrome. I'm basically in pain all the time from here all the way down to my left, to my left side of my neck, all the way down to my left hand. And this is a neurological and vascular disorder. So it's really, there's a lot going on, and it's been a journey in the medical industrial complex, let's say, where I also really learned that healing is really a collaboration with many people. Yes, you're trying to also figure out what's going on with your body, with a doctor who doesn't feel what you feel, but also knows so much more. And I also know a lot. So it was, it's been a really interesting experience to navigate that, and then alternative forms of healing, especially traditional Chinese medicine. So it's just amazing that I was already so interested in facilitating my work to allow other people to show up. But then suddenly I realized, whoa, oh my gosh, I'm really fucked, and I am in so much pain, and I also have to rest and figure out how to live my life from here. So it just added, I guess, fuel to the fire of increased accessibility. So my work at Costco has definitely been a way in which I have been able to test out a lot. And that's possible because of the size of Costco, the scale, also the flexibility. I mean, it's not so much that institutions are just, there's just one style of one. There's actually many different kinds, and it's not so fixed or concrete. But Costco being a smaller one allowed for instituting to also be something that has to do with access. So I felt like for me, I was able to actually put a lot of my crip wisdom and, after Leah Lakshmi Pipsna Samara Rinsa has talked about, using actually the wisdom from survivors or those with disabilities, the things that you learn of how to take care of yourself and other people is profound. So I was trying to use a little bit of my wisdom and also just to power up in other ways that I could about how to practice accessibility. So just to say too, I think, and this is really, it's not only this cohort from New York that I mentioned that has been really inspiring to me, but of course, Sins Invalid from the US. I mean, so I have more of a US perspective on disability. That's where I come from, but that's also a lot of the work that I engage with and read. But Sins Invalid and many other queer people of color who are doing the work of access and connecting it to other things like transformative justice and much more. So, and also lots of anti-capitalist critiques too. So, but so just drawing on this Sins Invalid, but also other folks like Mia Mingus, Stacey Milburn Parks, Alice Wong, who have talked about how access is a politic of love. And I think that was what I was really pushing for while at Costco and starting the accessibility work. Is that what does it really mean to make disability and accessibility so much at the forefront when you're beginning something that it's not an afterthought, it's not a burden, you're actually anticipating for other people to arrive. So this led me also to, just think about it as that accessibility is a very practice-oriented kind of work. I mean, there's a lot of theory. You can read all day long or listen all day long about all sorts of things, but it's really about putting it into practice. And I think we're at a really interesting point right now where there's more and more information and tools about accessibility, about the inclusion of people with disabilities or navigating illness or states of debility. But at the same time, I think what I'm noticing a little bit is this aestheticization of access, which maybe some of you also are seeing, and also in the fields of art and culture and design, that there's a look and feel to it. But there's also wait a second, what about the structural change? What about accommodations included in budgets? What about the actual employment of people with disabilities at these institutions? So it's kind of tough in this symbolic, performative, representational sort of field, such as art, that everyone kind of gets hooked on that. And while representation is really important, there has to be, you know, the change going on the underside. And it's not always like heroic, or you're not necessarily a superhero for doing access work. It's a little bit of the behind the scenes. And I think a lot of these mundane and maybe boring tasks, perhaps, are what's like absolutely necessary right now. At the same time, I really think that accessibility is such a creative practice. So, I mean, it's understandable that that it's being taken up for its various like aesthetic and poetic elements too. So I think just to add to that, I know that Melt was mentioned here, because I think that being in this critical point where there's more material and information and more of us involved, there's still like a lot of work to be done. I think this goes for many other struggles. And but for example, like Melt, who's a collective in Berlin who helped consulting on access for this event, has this amazing project related to, it's called an access server, which actually puts more responsibility onto the institution rather than the individual that needs to write to the institution to ask about the access needs, or I mean information, or what can be accommodated. So it's amazing. And then on the other hand, it's really important, places like Erica in Glasgow, social political art organization, that started developing access surveys so that they can have a better understanding of who's benefiting, who's using these accommodations that they're offering. So this is really great because we need an understanding of how this is all working as we're learning. Speaking of learning too, just because I think that it's like to really stay in the long haul of doing access work, it's so important that like there's a different relationship to making mistakes and failing. I think that's really important. I'm trying to listen a little bit more about like neuroplasticity and learning, and especially, you know, of course, if you want to like change your brain, you really have to, there has to be a kind of like a kit of reasons in order to do so, a sort of contingency. Often the case, it means someone has to become disabled themselves in some way in order to get on the bandwagon, let's say. But what other kind of reasons can we find that will allow that sort of selective shift? I mean, could it be that this event tonight for some of you is that like, oh yeah, I'm going to get more involved in this? Like, is that possible? And I think what's really important and what I'm learning from this neuroplasticity is that errors are just necessary for learning. It's actually the basis of neuroplasticity. So it's, yeah, just a little bit that I wrote down is that like an error is, for example, like if you were to, let's just say, now I'm just a little bit all over the place, but let's just say like this work of access, this work of care, this work of safety, all these things that we're wanting, they're like not complete projects. They're actually impossible in some sort of 100% full perfect way. That all has to be just kind of, you know, a little bit dumped out the window when in actuality we're all trying to go towards a horizon of sorts. So the striving for it looks a lot different. You can tell when you're trying. It's clear, you know, when you're not. And I think that there's a lot of institutions now, and we've talked about it, and it's about this event too, where live streaming got really good. It's still not perfect. We still have so much to work on. There's so much going on here also that it's just all about learning, but it's not simply about just totalizing standardized process of engagement. So what I mean to say is like when you make mistakes, which are necessary and for us to keep working on this, there's like these chemicals that are released from your brain, epinephrine, which is alertness, and then acetylcholine, which is focus. And that is like what's there to signal to you, okay, something has happened. And then you're really frustrated and you're like, oh, I've messed up. And then actually what is released is dopamine, which is to help you kind of get through it if you don't walk away from being frustrated. So I just find that this is really a kind of valuable thing. We kind of need to learn how to mess up and still keep going, especially in this social media time and so on. But so I'm going to start wrapping up now. But I just wanted to say, yeah, which is really maybe appropriate for the material, but also for our lives, you know, it's also about this kind of slow exposure and this incremental learning, because like anytime it's all going to be like way too much and you're not going to retain it, you also really have to practice it. You have to see how it feels to play with a different sort of accommodations to the point where the material really becomes reflexive. And so, I mean, I find this to all be really important, and I know it was mentioned just briefly about my death care work, but disability and death are really political things, especially when I'm connecting them like this. And maybe this is for a whole other talk, you know, but ultimately, I think it's a process of getting to know ourselves, which will also help with getting to know that actually other people have needs too that are different. And also acceptance. I think acceptance also that our lives are finite, and actually to be in a body is to be very vulnerable. And maybe I'll just leave there, but thank you all for your attention and the experimentation I just did.